you've got such a strong personality as an actor. When you're doing a role like this, are you conscious that you can't vary from what your audience expects of you?
No, I have. I think every actor, certainly I do. Perhaps that's true in television, but every actor likes to spread his range as widely as possible. I perhaps have had more opportunity than most actors to do that because I've played so many biographical roles. It's true that an actor with, in your phrase, a strong personality, I'm not certain what that means, or with a very distinct physiognomy.
Well, the people relate you from role to role to role to role.
Well,
still,
let's go at it another way.
Okay.
You learn very early on that once you've established any kind of a public identity, once you become, in other words, a public actor, as opposed to an anonymous actor, of which there are also some, but I'm always made a little nervous by the term star. It's loaded with all kinds of extraneous connotations, but certainly the term public actor is accurate and more useful for the purposes of this conversation. I've been a public actor for nearly 25 years now, and when you are a public actor, you are followed throughout your... Now, if that shadow is made up of one role, for example, the Jim Arness, obviously you have a formidable problem of varying that image. It would be almost impossible if, like Steve McQueen or Paul Newman, that shadow is made up of exclusively contemporary American roles, or maybe at the most late 19th century. Both of them have done a couple of westerns, not precisely period westerns, sort of semi-comic westerns. Then they would have a formidable problem, each of them, one suspects, in doing a period role. If, like Jack Lemmon, you've done mostly comedy, you have a similar problem, which he surmounted
in Save the Tiger.
He surmounted it in the eyes of his colleagues once before in Days of Wine and Roses, but the picture, for whatever reason, and it was an equally good performance, but for whatever reason, possibly for this reason we're discussing, the public did not accept him in it. It was not a commercially successful film, conceivably for that reason. As I said, I've probably had more chance than most American actors to vary that, whatever that shadow is of the other roles, because I've done so many different historical figures, certainly more than any other American actor. It's true that, again, your phrase, not mine, was a strong personality, and there's a certain kind, I can't play Uriah Heep, obviously.
That's what I was going to ask.
You know,
what you can't play.
I'm limited by my size, and
How many times have you played an anti-heroic part?
I'm not certain what the phrase anti-hero means.
Someone like John Wayne's played in The Searchers, you know, that role of the cowboy who becomes so committed that he's no longer a hero, his own...
I don't think that's what he's meant by anti-hero.
Don't you think that the character that Wayne plays in The Searchers is anti-hero?
Well, it depends on what one's definition of anti-hero, which is in my opinion, a very elastic term.
Okay.
I have played a number of unsympathetic characters. In fact, aside from the historical roles I've played, the biographical roles like Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson and Gordon and Mike Angelo and knows in the invented roles I've played, the fictional roles, more often than not, I'm kind of a surly son of a bitch who withal is aimed in the right direction and who usually along the course of the way is caught by the woman that the audience wants him to catch, you know. Half a dozen parts like that I've played. In my opinion, often in films that don't seem to me particularly effective creatively, and yet often have made a great deal of money. Diamond Head is an example. Ruby Gentry is another example. Naked Jungle is another example.
Which films do you feel were the most creative?
Well, that's
it. Let me ask you another question.
That's it. But you follow the point I'm making about the image?
Yeah.
It's, now, I think I've been either very fortunate or very successful or whatever you want, however you want to put it, maybe both, at giving myself as much elbow room in my range as I can, because I have done...
Has your audience ever, or has the audience that goes to the pictures ever... How can I say, you know, I come in and I
refuse to accept
yes,
it in a certain...
Yes, yes.
I've made certainly my share of flops, but I don't know that I can discern that they found me either inacceptable or implausible in a certain kind of thing. I think actors... Most actors develop a fairly sound sense of range, their own range. There may be reasons other than chance why, like I would love to do more comedies. I don't get chances to do many of them. Maybe, on the other hand, I've turned down a lot of parts that don't seem I don't get any gut reaction to. Maybe this is an unconscious sense of choice operating. Maybe Paul Newman feels the same way about playing non-Americans, you know. More than half my pictures have been non-American parts. Another half have been non-20th century parts. Almost all of his work is in the 20th century as an American. You know, maybe this is some subconscious sense of range operating. Personally, I've always felt perfectly at ease doing period things and non-American roles.
Well, the last two roles, maybe they aren't the last two roles, but Fleischer's picture and the one before that with the...
Soylent Green and Skyjacked?
No, before Skyjacked. The one where you... The
Christ
figure,
and
the Christ figure in the fountain.
Oh, Omega Man.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, those two films. I get just a gut feeling that you were bringing... That you were acting. Now that's a terrible thing to say, but that you were acting in those performances.
Well,
I could explain it to you.
No,
better.
There are several possibilities that would explain it. One, that the performance didn't work for you.
No, I'm not saying. I don't mean acting in a negative way at all. I meant that in those two films, I got a feeling that you got about as much out of the part as could be gotten.
Well, that's of course. An attractive idea. Both those pictures meant a great deal to me. Both of those pictures I chose to make and wanted very much to make. In the case of Omega Man, in the case of each film, it was a several year process to get it made and a lot of effort on my
part. I guess that's exactly, that there's a personal quality to those films.
The social comment implied in both films was important to me. I have a slightly misanthropic view of the world, and I've always thought of myself as a political liberal, except for the fact that most of I've become disenchanted with the liberal viewpoint because I think most of the of my liberal friends are such horses' asses about the potential of the human animal.
And you're an establishment. I don't mean again. All of these terms are terms.
Yeah.
You're an establishment liberal, are you not?
I guess.
You function in society as a leader and as a spokesman.
Well, I think one of the most asinine aspects of the liberal philosophy is that the main way to change society, that change is automatically good. I think something I do deeply believe is logically, something new, the chances are it's going to be bad. If you weigh it against the old, which has been what survives of the old has survived 2,000 years and 3,000 years of recorded history. So if you set that against something that just came up today, the chances are obviously what just came up today is going to be pretty lousy.
Well, Soylent Green is in total opposition to this thing, right?
Yeah.
That what we have has become so bad that...
Well, that's... yes, I also... I believe deeply that the most important social problem in the world, indeed so important that it has become the only social problem, is overpopulation. I think all the others pale to insignificance beside it. I believe this to the degree that I think it's, if you don't solve this, there's no point spending time and effort on, the problems of the aged, mass employment, traffic control, pollution.
What brought this home most strikingly to you? How did you suddenly, or not so suddenly?
Well, everything I've read since Swift's Gulliver's Travels on the subject, I think man is basically a foolish animal, quite capable of destroying himself, a violent, bloody-minded creature. I don't believe in the least that we have evolved from, and I don't think we are capable of evolving. The capacity for violence and foolishness is greed is deeply inbred in the beast, and the more specimens there are elbowing one another, the likelier these qualities are to operate, and this is really what Soylent Green is about.
You see man as very fallible. In your roles, especially recently, are you playing a man that's fallible?
Well, yes. The man in Soylent Green was brutalized beyond the only thing that kept him at all available to to human sensitivities was his experience living with the gentle old man from the past, Eddie Robinson. And thus, when he was thrown into contact with this pretty girl whom he regarded simply as sexual furniture and for whom he had no compassion whatever, somehow there was enough available raw material of humanity left in him that the death of the old man was able to trigger it.
Now, Fleischer sees things in terms of the wasteland, right? He is a symbolic director, is he not? I mean, he's admitted to me in a letter.
I guess,
That he has this wasteland motif in several of his films.
Certainly it's in that. Of course, that's inherent in the material there.
But there are a lot of directors who don't think along those symbolic lines, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Do you prefer... What's your feeling about the director who works symbolically?
I think it depends on the property, on the piece. I enjoyed working with Dick. I think he was the right director for that piece. I think he did a good job.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to interrupt 1 minute. That scene with Edward G. Robinson dying, which a lot of people have said was in bad taste, what do you think all about that?
In bad taste in what sense? Because he was in fact...
Well, first of all, that it was obvious and overdone. I'm not saying this. I like the film.
I think it's a very good scene. It's, I was, for one thing, it worked in performance. Actors always like scenes they do well. And the scene worked for me in performance. A couple of people I think, have been distressed by the scene because Robinson was in fact dying, because that in fact turned out to be his last scene he ever did, that scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was the last scene he did. But while he knew he was dying, none of us on the company knew it. It was clear that he was not well, but he was not a young man. He was, 77, I think. And I think Eddie did exactly what he wanted to, what most actors would. Most actors would like nothing better than to go out on a good part. And that was certainly the best part he'd had in 10 or 12 years. And he was a joy to work with. I'd worked with him before, of course, in Ten Commandments. The ideal casting for the role, of course. He emanated a kind of calloused gentleness, a calloused gentility and scholarly quality that was just right for a surviving artifact from the age of reason and civilization in this inhuman world that Silent Green portrayed.
Can you give me any, one or two examples of where you've invested something personally into a role?
Well, I like to think I invest something personal in every role.
Well, yes, but yeah. I mean, something specific, something.
Well.
See, I certainly view you as a consummate professional, and I want to see more of the creative man. I want to see more of the, I want to understand that creative element.
Well. I like to think of myself as a professional. I would be content with that for my epitaph. He was a pro. I've always liked the definition of a professional. A professional is I forget whose it was, but it's very good. Someone said a professional is a man who does his best even when he doesn't feel like it. And working in a profession, as I do, where time is so expensive, and so crucial to the success, to the creative as well as the commercial, to the creative success and the commercial survival of a project. Someone who cannot create professionally is, I can't have respect for. There's a great deal of tolerance.
Doesn't that, in this community. Compromising erode the talent, the creativeness? Do you reach a point where you have to say no?
Does what compromise? The
professional.
I don't think so. I think the reverse. I think many creative talents have been destroyed by unprofessionalism. You can pick your own examples, but Christ, you know, unprofessionalism covers a lot of things, but if you let your personal anxieties or insecurities or appetites compromise your capacity to use your instrument, which for an actor is his body, is himself, effectively, that you are being unprofessional and non-creative. You can't use it. If you get hooked on liquor or drugs or women or temperament, to the degree that it's constantly interfering with your work, you can't do it well. There are a dozen examples in films today of marvelous talents who haven't done a tenth of the work they should do because of their incapacity to control their own appetites in one or another of these areas.
Are you going to give me a personal example of that? Was Will Penny personal, or Soylent Green?
Curious
picture. Now?
Curious thing. Will Penny was certainly one of the best pictures I've made. I suppose it was one of the best performances I've given. Yet the part isn't very, again, we're back to this saying. It isn't very close to me, really, as to what either what the public seems to discern of me or to what I deem myself to be. This illiterate drifter is not very close to the parts I've played or to me.
He's an honorable man.
I was about to mention, the only thread that you can find in Will Penny which runs through a surprising number of my parts is it deals with the question of personal responsibility, as does Silent Green, as does El Cid, as does Number One, as does Planet of the Apes, for that matter, as does Antony and Cleopatra, and Julius Caesar.
The Gordon picture?
Yeah, cartoon, of course. The picture about Andrew Jackson, all these, Dundee, some of the worst pictures I've made and some of the best, are in a curious way terribly bound up, either the whole theme of the picture or at least the drive of the character, with an examination of personal responsibility. There are people like Mark Antony and Antony and Cleopatra who are destroyed because of their abdication. Again, the surrender to appetite. The tragedy of Mark Antony, who was a supremely gifted leader, supremely gifted, much more gifted than the man who replaced him, Octavius Caesar, who later became Augustus. But the tragic flaw in his character, which made an opening through which it all drained out, was his incapacity to control his dependence on his own pleasure. But in any event, it's curious because actors really, you can only do the part somebody offers you, with rare exceptions. I mean, I maybe made six pictures that were made because I saw a property or got an idea and somehow.
How many of those were commercial successes?
Not Antony, I'll tell you that.
Of those six that were...
Six was an arbitrary number. Well, let's see. Warlord was a commercial success, narrowly, because it was quite an expensive picture. It cost over $6 million. Silent Green was a commercial success. Large commercial success.
That's a surprise to me.
Oh, yes. Oh, that picture is currently grossed.
Now, is that because of foreign...
It's a big success here. It's the biggest hit that MGM had during the Aubrey regime. It's currently grossed just under $10 million. That's distributor's gross. That's not theater gross. That's return to the distributor. That was a success. Skyjack was submitted to me. That wasn't my project.
Omega Man
was a success, a more modest success, but a success.
So you've had a pretty good record. Well, this leads me to say, well, why don't you use your clout then?
I do when I can. They don't always make the pictures I want them to make. You can't, you know, sometimes they say, no, I don't think so. You would have thought, you know, MGM, during the Aubrey years, of course they're out of business now, it doesn't make any difference, I suppose that's what really, but they had about four successes, Shaft, the first Shaft, and Skyjacked, and Silent Green, and one or two others, but Skyjacked was the biggest success of the lot, and Silent, which is still really in release, is not far behind.
Every time you emphasize that, my little machine goes nuts.
Yeah. Why?
No, when you hit it. I'm just kidding.
And yet, the next, we submitted two projects to them that I wanted to do afterwards, and you'd think they'd say, go ahead, guys, but they didn't. However,
what were the projects?
One was a project called Old Fishhawk, about an old Indian in 1910 in Indiana that I kind of liked, but they didn't seem to think it was a viable project. And the other was a thing called The Osterman Weekend, which was a novel that was quite successful. But, you know, everyone has his own.
Now, did you, the Hawaiians and Number One were both given to you, or Pro? Or
oh, no, Number One. Hawaiians was submitted. Number One was a project I wanted very much to make and worked very hard to make. That was not a success.
It should have been a good picture, and it wasn't.
I know, and I can't figure out why.
I don't think the football came through. I don't think it...
Well, it wasn't supposed to be a picture about football.
It
was supposed to be...
The environment still has to be real,
well,
believable, doesn't it?
The only comfort I take in Number One is that when I talk to football players, they say, yeah, that's the way it is. Football players like it, but certainly the audience didn't. It was a dismal failure. And it may be, see now, of course, that picture is very much concerned with responsibility. The man's desperate, clinging to the thing he can do. That may have been a performance failure. I've looked at the picture a couple of times since, and there's a very cold, hostile quality to the characterization.
What else could you be opposite that actress? Who was in that thing?
Jessica Walters and Diane Lohauer.
Jessica Walters.
I don't know. I thought she was good in it.
Really?
I did. I liked her.
Isn't there some truth to the comment that was made that it was kind of like Ladies' Home Journal, though, covering pro football? Whoever made it didn't have a kind of...
If it did, you know, it was, as we went along, we thought we had it. You know, of course you always think that, or usually you do. That and Major Dundee are probably the bitterest wounds I have in films, because I was positive that each could be a good film.
Did you see The Sporting Life?
Yeah.
Do you like them?
Yes, very
much.
Because
that has the feel that the picture doesn't.
You must be right. Of course, Sporting Life didn't make any money either, but that's because nobody knows anything about rugby here. You must be right. It's very strange. It certainly didn't come off.
But sports pictures never are able to get the sports audience, are they? I mean, even Bang the Drum Slowly had a hard time.
That's true. And Bang the Drum Slowly is a lovely film. I'm suspicious of those old shibboleths, though.
Really?
You know, they say, oh, sports pictures never make money. Oh, this never, oh, that never happens.
Well, give me an example.
I guess there haven't been many. There have been a couple. And certainly, more often than not, they don't work. And I don't know why that is.
It's always perplexed me, and especially as a teacher, I teach at a university. When I try and convince students that people who are stars, which is a term you don't like, are actors as well. Especially...
Not necessarily. Sometimes.
Okay. Can be.
The terms are not interchangeable, but they can coexist.
Is John Wayne an actor?
Wayne does not have a lot of range, but he can play John Wayne awfully well. And that's not just a joke. You know, there's a kind of... I'll tell you what that popular misconception overlooks. And that's the enormous chemical weight that the security of a man like Wayne carries with him. There is a... He comes on the screen with almost a visible aura. And this is... I'm not speaking in a denigratory sense. You have to be, you know, Gable couldn't act, Wayne can act just as well as Gable could. Acting is both acting and stars are very slippery terms indeed. If by acting you mean the
I mean creative.
Well,
that's a slippery term too.
So that's slippery too. All right, you're really substituting another verb.
Well, you give me the term. I'm qualifying. Okay.
What I've found, the older I get, is that almost nothing is wholly true. You start out with a whole box of blacks and a whole box of whites. And then the longer you go through life, you keep saying, hey, there's a little gray in there. What son of a bitch, how about that? Over here, that's all white even. And this is certainly true of terms like acting and star and creative. Now, if you say a star is not an actor unless he can create another character, another persona in the way that Olivier can or that Muni could, then certainly Wayne cannot act at all. But on the other hand, there's a lot of guys that can create different personas that just aren't very interesting. If you put them in a long role, you get bored watching them. Now that's, you just do. A lot of very good actors in small parts.
For one, I think Stacey Keach strikes me that way.
Well, I'm kind of a Stacey Keach fan in the things that I've seen some things that I haven't seen his Hamlet, so I'm not counting that. But I think he's really good.
I'm talking purely as a film actor.
Film, yeah. Well, the things I've seen him in, I've liked mostly.
He's got the best pair of eyes, though. I mean, his eyes betray. I mean, I think they really harm him as an actor.
There's, for example, some marvelous stage actors. The two outstanding examples currently are probably Johnny Kennedy, Arthur Kennedy, and Jason Robards, who just don't work on the screen at all. Now, you can't say why that is. They're both good actors, but they're not very interesting on the screen. There was a theory 30 years ago that you had to be pretty. Well, that's not true, for Christ's sakes. Look at Jack Nicholson, you know. Then there was a theory that no, pretty boys are out. Look at Robert Redford, you know. It's a question of being interesting, and Wayne is interesting on the screen. They tell a marvelous story about Gary Cooper, who, while he was alive, excited the same people. It pisses people off who are interested in acting when someone who is not clearly marvelous at reading lines and creating characters and making dialogue effective and interesting still is a marvelously successful actor, and you say there's got to be something phony there, you know. I say it's a conspiracy, especially other actors say this. And they tell a story about when Cooper was doing For Whom the Bell Tolls with Akim Timurov, who was quite a characterizer, you know. And Timurov says, I will wipe him off the screen. Watch the first day's dailies. And he did whatever he was doing. And the next day he came back very upset. He said, that did not work. Must do something else. Must do less. Less is more.
That is For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yeah, For Whom the Bell Tolls. So he did another scene. And still, the bottom line was that if Cooper's on the screen, you're going to look at him. I did a picture with Cooper. And you look at dailies, actors looking at dailies only look at themselves. You find yourself fascinated with what... Now, Cooper, like Wayne, was not a facile reader of lines. He was... Like Wayne is easy to imitate. There's a certain kind of rhythm with which he says the lines, and they kind of grind out. And any two-bit graduate of an acting school can probably read dialogue better than that. And you say, well, he really can't act very well, can he? But you're interested in watching. And the same thing was true with Cooper. Cooper, the lines would sort of hitch out with pauses. But you couldn't take your eyes off him. Now, and this wasn't wholly just a chemical quality he had. He also was a skillful performer in other ways, a far more subtle actor than people realized. You look at his scenes with Walter Brennan in The Westerner, which have lovely edges of comic performance in them that make you realize that that's a very shallow judgment. But the point is that actors like Wayne and Cooper, to a certain extent, I think maybe the best screen actor we've ever had in America, Spencer Tracy, was, you know, he was a marvelous actor, but he was not too different in one part from another. You follow what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, there was that bulky stance and the walk and the looking down and then looking up like that, all that stuff was, that was what he was. That was the raw material with which he created. But you are mistaken if you imagine that because he cannot change his persona with the facility of with the enormous creative genius, if you like, because I happen to think he's the best actor alive, that Olivier can, that meant that Tracy, you know, was not creating. Now, obviously, I'm prejudiced a little because I have a large frame and a heavily boned face, and it's hard to make it look very different, you know. Actors with some actors, I think it's partly, after all, you're issued the equipment very early on in life, and you start dealing with it as a student actor in a certain way, and finding how it works, and what you can do, and what you can't do with it. And if you are a man of medium height, as Olivier and Muni both were, with rather, certainly not unattractive as a young man, Olivier was enormously handsome, but kind of neutral face, you know, I mean, evenly balanced with, you know, eyes the right depth, the nose a certain way.
Not the Heston nose.
Not broken in two places. And why, you find that you can do a lot of different things, and therefore you try to do a lot of different things. If you are burdened with 6'3" and a broken nose, why, you say, God, I can never even play Hamlet, let alone Rosencrantz, you know. I've got to stick to Macbeth and those taller fellas, you know. You therefore use your equipment in that direction. And certainly you don't develop the facility of the other kind of actors. Every actor has things he can do and things he can't, except Olivier, who can do everything.
How much of acting is taking risks?
I think a great deal in terms of development. You never grow if you don't do things that you're not certain you can bring off. That's why... That's one of the reasons I wanted to do Old Fish Hawk. That's one of the reasons why I do plays A and so much Shakespeare B, because those are the ultimate risks. Those are the moonshots. That's why I respect Keach enormously for doing Hamlet, you know. Those giant roles you never succeed in. Nobody's ever going to be a perfect Hamlet, because every man has the perfect Hamlet in his own mind, and you can't fulfill it. You can be so bloody marvelous the way Gielgud was in the mid-30s, and the way, well, of course it wasn't really Olivier's great performance, but in the great roles the way Olivier was in Othello, that your own conceptions are straight. You say, yeah, okay, that's what it is, but it's almost impossible. And so the main thing you get from them is stretching and growing and challenge and risk and loss. Again, in the classic roles, I'm limited in two ways. One, as an actor so large that there are some parts that, like Hamlet, it would be implausible for me, even, you know, even when I was a kid, it would have been. And two, as an American actor, where we have somewhat fewer chances to do Shakespeare, you have to, or at least I concluded very early on, that you have to pick a few parts and work on them all your life. Obviously, and I also believe of those roles that they are so much beyond the grasp, if not the reach, of any actor, that you are well advised to concentrate on the roles to which you can bring the most, where your physical characteristics will be an asset, not something that you have to somehow fit into the part. I mean, of course, there's nothing that says Hamlet can't be 6'3", but you have to persuade the audience, you have to spend a lot of energy persuading the audience that he can be. Whereas with Macbeth, that's a big help. If you're 5'9", then you got to spend time persuading the audience he can be 5'9", you know. So for me, those parts have been Macbeth, which I will do again next season for that will be the fifth time, and Mark Antony.
Now, where are you going to do Macbeth?
At the Amundsen. It's not announced yet, so I will. Now there are, also you got to figure out the great roles. Now I'm speaking as an American actor rather than an English actor. There are only five or six. I've turned down chances to do Coriolanus because it's not as good a part as Macbeth. You know, and I said, look, if you're going to do Shakespeare, let's do Macbeth, huh? And they say, well, gee, we just did it 3 years ago. And you say, well, okay, bad luck. But I don't want to mess with that.
How much recreating or new creating
to new
do
part of
go back?
It is. Because there's so much more. It's undiscovered country, you know. You come into it each time. See, now I haven't done Macbeth for 7 years, Christ. And you come to it, and there's stuff you said, how come I didn't figure that out before? How could I have missed that? Or how could I have done this that other way? That's a terrible way to do it, you know. Those things, all those parts are like mountain ranges. And there's, my son's a climber, and the terminology is, there are parallels. You say, well, that's an easy ascent, but that's a easy that bit. And then this one, if you go up this way, it's a bitch. You got to rope up, and that's a class 7 slope, you know. But you can go around this way, and it takes longer, but you can get up. Or maybe you should try something else. But like Macbeth is a bitch of a play. It almost never is a success. Because up through the murder, it's marvelous. Up through the banquet scene, and then somehow it gets tough. It's, as Macbeth is increasingly alienated from the rest of the people in the play, he becomes a more and more distant figure to the audience somehow. The play becomes closer and closer to Richard III, which is not, you know, it's simply not that good.
Is it because of the emphasis on Lady Macbeth?
No,
not at all.
Because she almost disappears. She has nothing to do except the sleepwalking after the banquet. I think the problem, every one of those parts has a major problem. The problem in Macbeth is to make him a tragic hero, not a villain. You've only got about 2 scenes at the beginning to do it in, you know, before he plunges into the acceptance of the murder. And from then on, you know. But each time you go at it, it's new.
There's, I don't know whether it's luck or... There's an actor who's fallen on times of futility. I'm thinking of Lee Marvin.
Yeah.
What happens?
I don't know. Actor, well, that's one of those actors. Booze is a, you know, it sounds like an old 1890s melodrama, but it's a terrible curse for an actor.
Did you see the Aldrich film, Emperor of the North?
No, I know the script very well.
Because
it should be very good. It should have been a marvelous thing to Lee.
I think it is, but it didn't go.
Well, I had misgivings about that film in script form. Sam Peckinpah had it for a while and wanted me to do it. And I said, there's nobody to be for in this film, Sam. And I think I didn't see the film, but there's more. He said, yeah, there is the train. I said, oh, Sam, don't give me that shit. I said, nobody's going to be for the train, for Christ's sake.
That's funny.
That was a desperate grab at something, you know, the train.
But can't you be for A number one? In his anti-heroism, isn't he an appealing character in a way?
Well, that's the answer most modern filmmakers would give you. But it didn't come off, I gather. Or did it?
It did for me.
Well, maybe
the problem is the kid, that cigarette character.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody for young people to relate to. I mean, they can't. They have a hard time relating to have class. That thing, you know. I mean, that's really the message of the film. You got to have class.
Yeah. But that's, you know, a picture. Many pictures nowadays are self-conscious pictures. Much art has become, art is going through a very self-conscious period. I think painting has destroyed itself by getting very self-conscious. The paintings are really about painting now. That's all they're about. You know, it's all the painting is about is the surface of the canvas and what's on it. And many films are increasingly involved with this. They're kind of put-downs of the idea of a film, the idea of involvement, and it's kind of like the man who many filmmakers and many actors in a part seem to be saying, look, I know this is just a film. I mean, I'm not trying to kid you, you know. For God's sakes, look, here's a little joke I'll tell you that proves it to you. And because they're afraid that it isn't going to come off. And if it doesn't come off, they say, you thought I'm kidding, for God's sakes. Don't be ridiculous. I ran a film yesterday which was one of the most puzzlingly flawed films I've ever seen in my life. I've seen many worse films. Much worse, and many elements in this film were marvelous, but I just thought it, especially considering the talents of the people involved. Did you see a film John Huston made 3 or 4 years ago called Judge Roy Bean?
Yes.
I don't know what it's about. It's, or what point he's making. The reason I ran it is the Goldwyn Estate is anxious to remake The Westerner, which was Cooper, William Wyler made it with Cooper and Walter Brennan as Roy Bean. And while the backstory involvement with the girl and the homesteaders is no longer viable, the relationship between Judge Roy Bean, Brennan, and this drifter cowboy works marvelously, and that's what the picture's about. Really, and it may well work as a remake, but we were distressed to, my son had seen this Judge Roy Bean, he said, and he, when we ran the other one, he saw and he said, you know, I saw a picture last year that they stole a lot of lines from, and, you know, John Milius is sort of a reproducing machine, and they do have, which is all right, I mean, there's some lines lifted, but not many, but the point is, this picture, in the first place, there's no clear point of view, whether they're doing who's the guy that made that thing, Flaming Saddles?
Blazing Saddles?
Mel Brooks. Yeah. Mel Brooks, the thing with Stacy Keach. About the only thing I've seen Stacy Keach do on the screen that I really hated was that Bad Bob thing, which is right out of Blazing Saddles. You know, I mean, it is totally, it's a parody of the Western Badman. I mean, you can't take it as anything but a gag for a second. Yet there are scenes in it that are treated very seriously and in which you are expected and indeed do become involved because they're well done. But Bean's ongoing is the thing he wants, which is the question you always ask as an actor of a role. You say, what does the guy want? And if you can't answer that in one quick sentence, you're in trouble. You know, now what does the Newman's character in Judge Roy Bean want? Well, a good quick thing is he wants to be powerful and he'd love to meet Lily Langtry. But he never does get to meet Lily Langtry. Although they paid Ava, I'm sure, a goodly sum to be Lily Langtry, which she doesn't get to be until the picture is over and there is a 5-minute epilogue when everybody else is dead. And we're now, indeed, according to the dates they've used, 70 years have passed. Now, how is she still, is she a ghost? Or, it's a curious, you know, very bad to knock films, somebody else's films, but you wouldn't do it if Houston and Newman were not such effective filmmakers. Houston is an artist of, you know, his best work is as good as anybody's best work.
Did you see Five Easy Pieces? Because there's a character that the whole point is he doesn't know what he wants.
Well, but see, now that, I think that worked because of Nicholson's marvelous performance. His desperate search for purpose, for meaning, for function, I suppose will do for what a picture's about. At least it worked, didn't it?
Yes, sir.
Because he was bloody good in it. And the scene with his, where he had with his father was deeply touching. And the kind of, the desperate anguish of the scene where he's playing the piano in the back of the moving van, and where he goes to watch, I remember many scenes from that film. It was a beautifully performed film. It was a, I don't suppose, I remember it for its performances. I wouldn't call it a great film. And I don't think it would have worked at all with less effective performances.
But that's part of the direction, isn't it?
Yes.
Part of Rapelson's.
Oh, yes. I mean, he deserves credit for it. But I mean, there are... great films, I think, have to have, really great films, have to have a basic structure that will work, you know, and I'm not certain that in my mind, Five Easy Pieces was a tour de force of performance in, for which Rafelson deserves his full share of credit. Any performance on the screen is, to a large extent, I didn't say major, but large extent, the director's responsibility, you know, you've got to, even if you have a genius, if you've got Tracy or Olivia, you've got to give him elbow room to do it in, and you've got to know how to cut it. You can ruin it by cutting it.
Have you seen Once Upon a Time in the West?
No.
Oh, you haven't?
No. It's
extraordinary.
Who's now?
Sergio Leone, with Henry Fonda playing the bad guy and Charles Bronson playing the Mexican. It's an extraordinary movie.
That's interesting, because I have never felt that the Italians had a very sure hand in the Western genre.
The amazing film about this thing about this film is it may try and do what Judge Roy Bean does, but it does it so much better. It parodies the form at the same time that it accepts it, and it's kind of a new entity. It's like a new, it's homage to the West, it's elevating, and yet it's also...
Was that what Houston was trying to do? Do you agree with my comments about the other thing?
I think it failed. But I think it was so eclectic and that there was just kind of a chaos in there. But I think he was parodying the form of the Western at the same time that there was kind of a...
Now he started out and when, the slim act, Tony Perkins, the little sequence with Tony Perkins, I thought, we're going to have, you know, Canterbury Tales, different traveler's view of this guy, and we will understand him through their vision, and they're all speaking from purgatory or hell or heaven or wherever. But then he abandoned that device, and he never used it again. The thing of, you know, if you have an actor play to the camera, that's a very, now you're really doing a documentary, you know, it's a different sort of thing. And he never used it again. Then he had a narrator who we didn't know who the narrator was.
I know. Don't you find that the films in the last couple of years are doing different things in the same film? I mean, it seems that your sense of formalism is warring with,
yes,
with something that's coming into film, where Bonnie and Clyde can have a moment of out in the in that nostalgia when they visit her parents, and then this shooting up people, and then the next minute it's that banjo music. I mean, it throws us from...
I like a more whole to a film. I like one point of view. Now, you know, this doesn't mean that the out-of-towners is that a comedy or a bitter black piece, you know? It's both, but it somehow it all works together, doesn't it? You know? It's a film I just made for Dick Lester, which I can boast about because my own part is so small. But I think Lester did in Three Musketeers what Houston failed to do, if that's what he was trying to do, and I don't know that it was, in Judge Roy Bean. Lester brought you right up to the edge and made it as funny as he possibly could, without taking it to the point where you said, well, none of this is real, who cares, you know, who cares whether they get back with the diamonds, you know, that cardinal's not going to kill anybody, you know. But he kept you just this side of that. I think he captured the picaresque extravagance of Dumas' original better than any of the other versions have done before, because he recognized the humor in it.
You think this is going to work with an audience? I heard that it's really on shaky legs, audience-wise.
Well, I don't know. It, of course, it's just over in France. It did very well. It's just opened here. It remains to be seen. Obviously, I gave up trying to predict what would.
Well, now Lester has more form and more control than Houston had in the film.
I would say yes, yes. I think he's a fascinating director. I loved working for him. Mostly watching, because he said to me, now he said, you can't do any of this. He said, you have to be real. He said, you have to be as though we were doing a biography of Cardinal Richelieu. So I was, you know, I'm just in bits of it, but I was enchanted with the way he handled it. He never uses a moving camera. His style is highly personal. Didn't even have a crab dolly on the set, let alone a Chapman boom. And uses very few close-ups, in fact. He says, especially for comedy, everything has to happen in the frame. He said, you can't do it with cuts. He said, the audience has to see it happen, or they won't laugh.
And what makes this personal?
His style is a deeply personal style. I've never worked for a director who worked in that way, whose visual style was as unique as that.
You worked for Sam Peckinpah.
Sam's editing style, and now I wouldn't say that Sam's instincts for violence on the screen, which have become debased and are spoiled by excess, are certainly not unique to him. There are a lot of other directors, Sammy Fuller for one, Don Siegel for another.
Are you you're also you're not a great fan of Robert Altman's, I get the feeling.
I haven't seen all of his films. What was the one he did in the Astrodome?
Oh, Booster McCloud.
I did see that, and I just, I got...
You didn't see McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
No, I didn't see that. I saw two reels of it when he was dubbing it, and I liked much of what I saw there.
Would you rather work for a director who is a personal director or one who is professional? And I don't mean that a personal director can't be professional, but...
Well...
I mean, for an actor, what are the benefits and what are the liabilities?
I think you have to figure, you know. From my point of view, that's one of the advantages of being totally professional as an actor. You can, if you feel that a certain director will do the picture better than anyone else, you can say, okay, I can manage, I can survive this. Sam is just murder to work with, you know. You got to sit up all night in those Mexican whorehouses drinking tequila with him. You know, he's just tough. And you've got to be Sam's closest friend or you're his enemy. And you can't work for a director who is your enemy. Therefore, you have to be his closest friend, and that takes a lot of time. Working with Orson is just the reverse, because Orson will seduce you. Orson understands the necessity of communicating with actors. And working with Wells is more fun than working with anybody.
Where does that picture, where does Touch of Evil stack up in the ones you've done?
It's...
The top, at the bottom?
Oh, no. I think it's a good film. I think it was a little ahead of its time. I think it's... a more non-linear film than was common at the time. It's certainly not a great film, although it has its clique of fervent admirers. It's sort of a cult film, but that doesn't really prove anything, you know. Cult films are often sort of bizarre little films, and that is a bizarre film. I probably learned more about acting in that film from Wells than I ever had in any one film from any one director, which is not necessarily to say that I gave my best performance in it, because I don't think I did, but just about acting overall.
How so?
Well, for one thing, Wells is himself an actor, and quite a good one. Is a very talented actor, not a very disciplined one, but very talented and very, very bright. Wells is an enormously bright man, you know.
Witty or bright?
No, I mean intelligent. I mean, he is very intelligent. There is a large brain there. And being an actor, he understands the necessity of bringing actors along and patting them a little, and he works with them. Many very fine directors kind of push actors around. I don't mean that way, but...
Manipulate them?
Well, they deal with them. They recognize that the performance has to come out of the actor, and that if you tell them something, they probably will do it if they have any brains and are able to change what they've done before. But they don't communicate with them. Willie Wyler is probably an outstanding example of this. Now, I did two performances for Willie, and they're both good performances. But they're good because Willie won't quit till they are, and because he has impeccable taste in performance. He knows absolutely when something is a little too much or a little too little, but he doesn't have any clue. He doesn't really like actors particularly. Oddly enough, Willie is one of the few directors I've worked with whom I've maintained a close personal relationship. And personally, Willie's a charming, lovely man, and we get on very well. We exchange dinners every so often. But he's retired now. But on the set, he was then not a brute or a tyrant in the sense we hear Preminger and Hathaway were, but just incapable of communicating on any empathic level with the actor. You'd think a man with that kind of instinct for performance, and all his pictures are studded with remarkable performances from the actors in them. A wide range of actors. But he just tells you that that wasn't good and this wasn't good, and do more of this and less of the other, and you get a feeling of ill-concealed impatience from him that it's taking you so long to get it right. I wish Willie would do one more picture. I'd love to go through it again, you know.
What would be an example where he knew something was too much or not enough? Can you think of one?
Well, he changes his mind all the time, which is okay. Now see, again, a lot of actors are very upset by that and for the fact that he's not nice to them. I don't care. He'll say, that's okay. He said, let's do another take. Now, when you're listening to Chuck, you're interested, but you really want to talk about Altman's films, and this talk about Ben-Hur is not that important to you. It will serve no purpose in your story. So you're interested and pleasant, but you're thinking behind of a way to introduce another question. You do another take like that. And he says, yeah, do it. That's good. He said, do a little more of that. He said, maybe look at your watch once. Find a place where you look at your watch where that Chuck can't see. And you do that, and you do two or three takes, and he said, I don't know, he said, you seem bored in it now. And you say, well, you said that I'm not really interested in this part of the interview. And he says, yeah, but that's no good, we can't do it that way, we've got to do something else. And it's like building a tower of matches on a milk bottle, you know, and it's a towering edifice of tiny little, and each thing he says, he'll say, it's okay when you shift your position, but don't look so intently at Chuck, you see. Yeah, okay, I see that, yeah, that's not good. He said, it's distracting when you do that. And you see, finally you're doing a take and there are 23 little things that he has told you. And you recognize that each one is correct. But then the problem, then he'll say, he said, that's all very good, it's got everything in it now. But he said, it has no spontaneity at all. You say, well, Jesus, I wouldn't wonder it doesn't have any spontaneity. He said, well, we'll have to go back to the beginning then. And so, you know, and it's just exhausting.
See the film, because he's a perfectionist,
what's the best you can do? You look at each, you say, yeah, I can't do it any better than that.
Did you ever walk off a set? Never in your career. You've certainly had reason to, I presume.
Well, I do not suffer late actresses gladly, but that's my greatest vulnerability. Ladies who come late, and I have been surely, but if the ladies are of not such towering reputation that they can be spoken to that way, why, the director or the producer always communicates that in advance.
This has been a male chauvinist conversation. That's the second time in the whole time we've mentioned women, I think. How about female actresses, are there?
Well, I found it to make comparative references to actresses because it pisses the ones off you don't mention.
How about Jane Fonda?
I've never worked with her.
I mean, did you see Clute?
Yeah, I thought she was very good in Clute. I think she's a foolish lady, and I disagree.
It really hasn't hurt her talent, though, has it?
hasn't hurt her talent, it's hurt her employability. If you like, is a good example. She is a remarkably talented actress. You know, they shoot horses, don't they? Glute. I didn't see Doll's House. I would think so. It'd be a good part for her. But she's gone charging around in these variety of causes in which she's, rendered herself nearly unemployable, which is too bad.
Now, why is she unemployable? Because
I don't say categorically that she is unemployable, but she is not employed. I suppose box office, yeah. She pissed off a lot of people, including me, with her comments about the prisoners of war. You know,
she did, thank goodness, handle the acceptance of the Oscar properly.
Yeah. But I've worked with some lovely ladies, Gene Simmons, a couple of others.
How about the one in Wopenny?
Joan Hackett. Yeah, very good actress. Lovely
actress. It never really has...
Hard to cast, I guess. I don't know. It's awfully hard for a girl to become a star now. It always was, but with less production, it's even harder. There aren't many parts, or as many, and there are at least twice as many women competing for them as there are men. I thought Joan was just marvelous in that. Just marvelous.
Now, there was a chemistry between the two of you in that film.
Yeah, that worked very well.
How often, what other film has that happened where there's an obvious chemistry, romantic chemistry, or is that very unusual?
Well, this may be a lack on my part. I don't communicate the phenomenon of the lady star is a difficult thing to deal with. And it's sometimes hard to find the woman in there to communicate with as actor to actress, or not the woman if you like.
Now, Joan Hackett was not a star. Is this why that one of the reasons?
It may have been, I don't know. On the other hand, Gene Simmons is a star, and she is, I think, a marvelous actress. I think an overlooked and underrated actress. I think, in a curious way, stardom can... See, you can use the word in this context because it's what we're talking about, really. Stardom can cripple a woman perhaps more often than a man. I don't really know why that should be so, but observation leads me to think it is. It's a cruddy way for a girl to make a living. It really is. And it seems to complicate their lives more than it sometimes does for men. I don't know why that should be so. I know that sounds like a very male-y chauvinist comment, but I don't really mean it that way. I think there are simply different problems for a woman than for a man. Perhaps that's less true now than it used to be, but I think it's still true.
But as an actor, you're suggesting that this has affected or influenced the romantic nature of your films, the charisma, the
I think sometimes I I made a very successful romantic picture with Jennifer Jones, who was a big star, of course. And another one, Naked Jungle, with, I'm speaking successfully, commercially, of course. Although Ruby Gentry is not a bad picture. And another one with the Naked Jungle with Eleanor Parker. And another one with a rather incestuous relationship with Yvette Mimieux and Diamond Head. And of course Gene Simmons, but in Big Country, which is the only picture I've ever made with her, I didn't have a romantic relationship with her. I just recognize her as an actress of some capacity and a woman who has survived the slings and arrows of feminine stardom with remarkable grace. I have not done, with those exceptions, and of course we said Joan Hackett, many pictures with great female stars where I thought the chemistry worked. Now you have to suspect that the fault is in some way mine, if it does, you know, if it doesn't work.
The chemistry worked with Laurence Olivier though, didn't it?
And
in a sense with Robinson and
yes, yeah, it isn't that, or when with Cooper in the film I made with Cooper.
I hadn't realized how often it was a male relationship.
Now of course El Cid was an overwhelmingly successful film commercially, and I think visually is a beautiful film. I think that's a film I have regrets about. I think in the hands of a Lean or a Wyler, that could have been the greatest epic film ever made, because it's the best story. But it is merely a good film with a remarkable visual quality. And the relationship with Sophia, which is the core of it, is plausible, but not explosive. And I would, you know, I have to question myself in that context.
How?
I don't know. I mean, on the record, it, one would have to say, well, if you'd done four or five films with big female stars, have I done, let's see, I guess I haven't really, not a lot. Interesting thing in another context, Ben-Hur had the, you know, the central relationship with the girl. We use this Israeli actress, Haya Haravit, who was very good. Again, I was not particularly drawn to her personally, but I admired her capacity enormously. She was a very good actress, especially it was her first major role, and she was, I thought, very good. But none of the scenes worked. Now, we could argue, if you like, that in some way this lack of chemistry was handicapping it, but I don't know. Christopher Fry, who wrote on the script throughout production, had an interesting theory, because we shot several of the scenes, we shot two of the scenes over and rewrote others in advance of shooting several times. And finally Christopher said one day, he said, you know, he said, if this were not semi-classic and I were writing it, he said, I would take out the girl. He said the central relationship in Ben-Hur is between Ben-Hur and Salah, the two boyhood friends who come to hate each other. And he said, this is what the audience is interested in. He said, it's not that the other scenes aren't well written. It's not that we're not doing them well. He said, it's that the audience's instincts are to get back to the other thing. What's Masala doing? What is going to happen with the Romans? And in that particular instance, I've come to believe he was right. But
fascinating. I find it really fascinating, this whole element, which I'd never even thought of before.
It's true that a great many of my films have, well, all of the films which have been biographical films, I mean, if you're doing a film about a president or a saint or a genius, why they're too busy painting the Sistine ceiling or conquering Valencia or defending Khartoum, you know, there just isn't time for all this other, or just for a brief momentary fling. But so you have to put those films aside. And some of the others, Major Dundee was a good example of this thing. We used a girl named Senta Berger in it, who again was not a big star. Now, for the little bit that we used of the relationship, that worked well enough, I think. But I've played a lot of men with something eating at them, so that the woman in the piece is a distraction, perhaps a welcome distraction, perhaps a relief, but nonetheless deviant from the main thrust of what the character wants. I suppose Gloria Steinem would make a good case for the whole line of parts as being the ultimate in male chauvinism in Planet of the Apes, why the girl was mute.
I got just maybe two real quick ones.
Yeah.
The Janet Leigh part was secondary too, then, wasn't it? Your relationship was more with Orson Welles' character?
Well, see, if you remember, she disappeared through the whole film. Now, she was the thrust of the piece. I mean, his whole drive was to find his wife, and worked very well. But she's not there, he doesn't find her till the end. I mean, he loses her, in the second reel, and he doesn't get her back till the very end, so that can't count.
Secondly, would you say that romantic chemistry with Joan Hackett on the screen was the apogee of that? Was the time that it worked best for you, or...?
I would think, probably, yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
It's a very personal kind of performance, isn't it? By both of you?
I have... You know, you're getting into rather delicate areas.
Of course.
I have played with girls to whom I was more sexually attracted than I was to Joan. To whom, while she's a striking and attractive lady and a thorough professional, and it's very hard for me to be attracted by any girl who isn't a good actress, but I was not sexually drawn to her, and yet the chemistry worked. Now, you could say Tommy Grise had a good hand in that. His writing of the scenes was, I think, the best writing he's done. Her abilities as a performer, which are considerable, or this chemistry. You see, the point I'm trying to make is this man-woman chemistry, people imagine simply to be sexual chemistry working, and I don't think it, because I've once or twice played with actresses to whom I was attracted sexually, but for a variety of reasons, perhaps I didn't think they were very good actresses, I was annoyed with them, working with them, and therefore I failed to create this other chemistry, which is not quite the same thing. Now, of course, as has been demonstrated in many films, if you are either asexually attracted, if there is a strong sexual attraction between a man and a woman, or B, an actual sexual physical involvement, that more often than not will photograph. You know, I mean, it will register and work. But this, the reverse can be true too. And another alternative, you can have this chemistry without the sexual attraction, as witness Joan Hackett. Very curious. It's all very subjective stuff.
Last question. That film, would you say that's the most natural film you've ever made, where your performance was the most natural?
No, because actually I don't talk like that.
That blows. Yeah, but I don't mean talk. I mean in a quality. There was a quality of natural.
Well, by natural, you have to define your terms then. I assume when an actor, when you say your most natural performance, most actors presume you to mean most like yourself.
No.
With the least reaching for another characterization. Oh, what do you mean?
Most credible, most believable, most...
Then you mean best, don't you?
Well, but that's not the term I really want. I think in relation to your other pictures, there's a quietude about that picture.
Well, that's inherent in the man.
There's a casual, there's a relaxed...
He's not trying to be president.
Yeah.
Or paint the Sistine Ceiling, or take Valencia, you know.
That's a very good line.
You will, a final postscript on the this business of sexual magnetism. The Warlord, which is about sexual obsession, that's what the whole picture is about. I think that worked, although I was not particularly attracted to the girl in that. But I think you believe the man's almost sick obsession with the girl in that.
Maybe that's what I'm saying. Maybe I'm saying that that's one of the few characters where you're not obsessed. Not one of the few.
Yeah,
but
you mean
one of your qualities
you're quite right. Sure. I've played all kinds of men driven to accomplish something, you know. In Warlord, to somehow have this girl at all costs, or in El Cid to save Spain, or, you know, to be elected president, or paint the Sistine Ceiling, or, you know, in Major Dundee to destroy the Apache.
Touch of Evil
to find his wife. I played driven men, and in Will Penny, that's true. Number one is a driven man. The Hawaiians, Planet of the Apes, drive to survive. You know that.
Why haven't you shown that other side more often? That unobsessed.
Well, I've never seen scripts. Old Fishhawk has some of that quality. If you like Will Penny, in my opinion, you would like Old Fishhawk. But maybe I've done so many of the obsessed men that when they get obsessed scripts, they say, yeah, right, let's get Jack Heston, you know.